This is the No Doubt Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Brandon Minnick, a developer advocate at Microsoft, and he's joining me from San Francisco. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Brandon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Brad.
This is our third podcast, but for people who don't know you, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Of course, yeah, and thanks for having me back. I work as a developer advocate at Microsoft. I'm a longtime mobile app developer. I actually used to work at a company called Xamarin, which Microsoft acquired a couple years ago. So that's how I snuck into working at Microsoft. And yeah, I recently pushed a new iOS Android app to the app stores and wanted to chat with you and our listeners today kind of about that journey.
Yeah. But before we get on to that part, can you tell us, you didn't just go to the app store first. You built it as an open source project on GitHub. Can you kind of tell us what the project did, and how you were kind of, I suppose, sideloading it initially?
Yeah. So as a developer advocate, it's one of my favorite things is we get to play around with a lot of the latest, coolest technology, and we get to make a lot of samples that fellow developers can reference. And one of the things I like to do is try to make something that's also helpful. And probably about a year ago, I started playing around. Actually, let's go back another year, 2 years ago. I started playing around with GraphQL. And one of the first GraphQL APIs that I discovered was the GitHub API. And so I went down this really cool rabbit hole with GraphQL and started making some samples around that for fellow Xamarin developers. So if you want to create an iOS or Android app that uses a GraphQL API, here's some code that will do it for you, or at least you can reference to maybe inspire you for your app. And as I was working on that, around the same time, I found that I had a couple, well, more than a couple repos in GitHub that had just gone stale. I hadn't touched them, hadn't looked at them for a couple years. And I try to keep all my code up to date just in case somebody stumbles upon it from maybe an old blog post or an old video. But a couple repos that I thought nobody's looking at this anymore. And I dug into the statistics. There's on GitHub, if you click in the Insights tab and then go into the, I think it's the Trends tab after that, you can see how many people view your repo, how many people clone the repo, where that traffic's coming from. Maybe it's from the blog post or Twitter or Reddit. And yeah, I discovered I had a couple of super old repos with stale code in them that were still getting 10, 20 views a week. So I started building on this knowledge I had of mobile and GraphQL and GitHub's GraphQL API specifically to, it's like, what if I could aggregate all this data for my repos, then I could in one place quickly be able to see how many views, how many clones, how many stars, forks, et cetera, each of my repos are getting. And then that'll help me be able to make sure I don't have repos that are going stale anymore. And so that kind of led to me creating this sample app called Git Trends that, like you mentioned, I'd been just sideloading on my phone. And, you know, the UI wasn't great. I'm a developer, not a designer, so it was very functional. But even my wife will tell you, she told me that you can tell a developer made it, which is a loving way to say that the UI is not great. And so, yeah, I'd been using it myself. It still is and always has been open source on GitHub. But yeah, for other fellow developers to take advantage of it, you had to sideload it onto your device. And sometimes that's easy, sometimes it's not. So, you know, the code's there. So for a fellow Xamarin developer, somebody that's familiar with building iOS and Android apps in Visual Studio, yeah, no problem. Clone the repo, sideload it onto your app, connect to GitHub, you're off and running. But if you've never done that before, it's pretty daunting. There's a lot of a lot of tools you need to install, a lot of libraries, a lot of dependencies, updates that you need to make sure you have. And so I decided one day that, you know, why not share this app with the world? I can put this on the App Store, then nobody has to worry about trying to figure out how to sideload it, trying to figure out how to install this other stuff. And it's still open source, so if anybody wants to, that's still fine. But yeah, I figured let's put it up on the App Store and maybe some people will use it. But if nothing else, then I'll at least have an easy way to continue monitoring my GitHub repos.
And just for people who aren't familiar, what is sideloading?
Oh, good question. So sideloading is anytime you install an app on your phone that did not come from the App Store.
And this is either the Google one or the Apple one.
The Google has the Google Play Store, Apple has the iOS App Store, and that's where you should be getting your apps. But if you know how to switch your phone or your tablet into developer mode, then yeah, you can just take that file. Like on Android, it's either an APK or an AAB, an Android App Bundle file, and literally I could email you that file right now and you could install the app on Android from that email. On iOS, they make you jump through a couple more hoops. It's all done with security in mind. So as a user of iPhone and iOS apps, I love it because I know there's that extra level of security. But as a developer, it can be really painful because these are things we have to do a lot. But yeah, so sideloading isn't the most... isn't the easiest path forward for anybody that wants to try out your app.
But in your case, it was more difficult than that. It was plain source code files that would require them to download the source code, compile it, turn it into that, let's say, APK, and then move it across. So it would really only be a developer.
Point.
Whereas, you know, I could, there are some applications that I download from the websites of the companies that make them because they have the official App Store version and then they've got the Play Store version and then they've got the slightly unofficial one that they provide you. But that's as simple as going onto their website in Firefox or whatever, downloading and then giving it an okay, yes, I trust where this came from. But your scenario was much, much more complicated.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I jumped from just open source repo to the App Store.
You have to be a developer in the first case.
What I probably could have done is generated those APK, IPA files and hosted them on GitHub as well as a interim step to help anybody that's also familiar with it. But yeah, we should have talked sooner. I didn't think of that before. Mm.
But this isn't the first app that you've ever released. So, You had a quite difficult time getting this one in. Was the first app also as bad?
It's always painful to push an app to the App Store, even if you've done it before, because both app stores have a review process. They both have rules, regulations that you have to follow. And in that review process, both Apple and Google make the rules for what apps will be allowed in the App Store and what terms of service you have to abide by. And then when you submit your app, they review it first. And most of the time it's, hey, let's make sure this app still works. Let's make sure it doesn't crash as soon as it's launched. And then let's make sure it does what it's supposed to do. And if they find that your app violates any of their terms, then they just reject it. So they say, nope, sorry, you violated... We'll make up something like section 3A, paragraph C of the law book. And then you're kind of left bag in hand to say, what does that mean? Because the rules are also very vague. So they are, we'll say, intentionally up for interpretation. And so you're left trying to interpret the rule that they're pointing to. And then also trying to figure out how it then applies to your app, which is a difficult adventure in of itself, because I've even had situations, and I know fellow mobile app developers that have recommended just don't change anything and just click submit again. See what happens, because sometimes it'll go to a different reviewer and they'll interpret the rules differently. And then next thing you know, you made it to the App Store. So it's kind of like the Wild West when it comes to reviewing.
So that makes it sound like a manual process as opposed to, you know, a wonderful automated process being run by, you know, deploying it to hundreds of phones, seeing what it does, seeing if it works. Because I remember seeing, I think it was at a Microsoft Build video, talking about how Microsoft used to be able to run applications on hundreds of physical phones in a test center. They'd run them screen down so that it wouldn't be visible to the people that were working there. You know, they might have to go occasionally and connect wires or disconnect chargers or something, but they were face down so that private information wouldn't be released. But it sounds like what you're saying is it's a person sitting with a phone clicking or tapping or swiping.
Well, that's what I imagine. So we'll say quick shout out. What you just referred to is called AppSetter Test. So if there is anybody else out there that wants to see your app running on different devices, yeah, Microsoft has a whole device farm where you can choose an iPhone 8 running iOS 11 to run your device. And it's really nice, especially if you don't have that device at your home. You can just kind of let it run. And it is real devices. Yeah, like you said, it's like a data center, but instead of servers, it's just rows and rows of phones and tablets. But yeah, I mean, I will say the caveat here is this is my speculation, because I've never worked at Apple or Google. I don't have the insight into their process, and it could change tomorrow. But yeah, the way I put in pieces together, assume it works, is there's a mixture of both, because, like, for example, when I push to the Google Play Store, Android will run what's called a pre-launch report, and they'll send me videos of my app running on, I forget the exact number, but let's say 6 or 8 devices. And it looks like that is an automated script just kind of tapping random buttons, because the behavior you see in the video doesn't really replicate anything you would see from a user. But again, they're just looking to make sure that the app doesn't crash right away and maybe do some like crazy navigation back and forth to see if they could induce a memory leak or a crash. But with iOS, they don't give a video report, but because we, as mobile developers, well, I won't speak for everybody, but most mobile developers will have some sort of crash reporting analytics tool baked in. So anytime anybody taps a button in the app or launches your app, you can see that activity. And so I've been able to see that people are opening the app in Mountain View, and then people are also opening the app in Ireland for Apple's review process. And that does look like it's a user just based off of the user flow. It doesn't have that weird flow that I see in the Android videos. It looks like somebody sees the button that says log in and taps that one first, or sees the button that says do this and is following the instructions on the screen more or less.
What were some, so aside from, let's say, the videos you got back from Google, was your app rejected a few times? Did you have to? Okay. Let's start with the first time.
Oh man. So, all right. Yeah. Apple's review process is a lot more stringent. And in fact, like Android, there used to be a day where you just said submit and it was immediately on the Google Play Store. Not so much anymore, but yeah, with Apple, they initially rejected the app and they said, we can't test this to confirm it does what you tell us it's supposed to do, because we can't, and I'm going to do air quotes, log in. And yeah, I replied to that email and I was like, yeah, I don't know what you mean, because there is no login. You just connect to GitHub. Like, you're not creating an account. I'm not managing users or anything like that. So, you know, I can't really give you a dummy account, but if you have a GitHub account, you want to try it, go for it. And obviously that got zero response. They never wrote me back on that. So I said, okay, I know how to fix this. I'll make a demo mode. So you don't have to connect to your GitHub account to try it out. You can say try demo, and then you'll be able to see everything. So the charts and graphs will be there. It's just dummy data. And no way they'll reject that. But sure enough, they rejected that. Because they said, again, it's the same excuse. They're like, we can't log into your app. I'm like, I don't know how to explain this to you, but there is no login. You just connect to GitHub. But here's the demo mode that does the same thing. So it's like, all right, they're not going to let me into the App Store unless I give them an account. So I was like, fine, I'll make a fake account on GitHub. I'll give them the username and password. Let them log in. This is an account I'll never use for anything else. Go for it. And then I wake up the next morning to an email from Apple that obviously got rejected again. But this time it was that the login failed. And I was like, what do you mean the login failed? I didn't include two-factor auth. Like, how could this happen? Well, turns out GitHub security policies noticed that there was a login from Mountain View followed by a login somewhere in Ireland.
Yeah,
they're pretty aggressive. Hey, wait a minute. Yeah. This looks suspicious. And they put the kibosh on that account. It's like, okay, well, I guess that's a good thing. I would want GitHub to do that if they found it from my real account. So can't fault them there. And yeah, I start Googling around like, how do you get around this security policy? And the only way around it was to create a two-factor auth or to enable two-factor auth for your GitHub account, which then I'm like, okay, well, I can do that. But then they can't log in with the username and password anymore. They need the two-factor auth. And so what I ended up doing was, yeah, enabling two-factor and then giving them the code so they could go into an authenticator app like Microsoft Authenticator, Google Authenticator, enter in that code. It would give them the rolling two-factor auth. And then finally, I was able to get it into the App Store. So that was about, I think, 8 back and forths I did initially with Apple.
That itself is impressive that you got them to, you know, install an authenticator app for your account and then pull out the code, because those codes only last something like a minute or a minute and a half at a time.
Right. So I have to assume they've dealt with this before, but what I learned and the big difference here was the first app that I pushed to the App Store, it's called Punday. Check it out, download it, give it 5 stars. But there's no logging in. There's no authenticating users. There's no connecting to anything like GitHub. And so I never had to go through this authentication flow before. But I knew when you submit your app to Apple that they have a couple boxes that you can fill out if they need to log in, where you can provide a username and password. And so I knew that existed. I'd never used it before. But what I also discovered on this go-around is below that, there's a box of basically instructions. So if you need to tell the user how to log in, you can say, like, here's how to navigate to the settings page where you can log in, for example. And so, yeah, in there, I just wrote the most detailed instructions I could think of for downloading and installing Google Authenticator, navigating your way through that app to add in the two-factor auth code to give you the rolling codes, and just kind of had to cross my fingers and hope that whoever was reading these instructions, could figure them out. Like, do my instructions make sense? But also B, is willing to go that extra mile to literally install another app like Google Authenticator to get the rolling code, then come back to my app and apply that. And so that's what I didn't know, or wasn't sure if that would happen. And luckily it did, because if that didn't work, I have no idea how I would get this app through the App Store review process.
So you got that part. Was your app accepted at that point, or did they come back to you and say, oh, you know, you're missing an icon, or you don't have a splash screen or something?
Oh, good question. So they do alert you to things like that. But they're at least nice enough to alert you as soon as you upload your app to the, we'll call it the Apple Developer Portal. So developer.apple.com, you first push your app to them, and that's where they'll do a quick check. So they'll make sure that, yeah, the basics are there. Like, are you missing a splash screen? Are you missing an icon? iOS is also very security conscious, if you couldn't tell so far. But you, if your app wants to do anything outside of itself, like, for example, in Git Trends, if you tap on your GitHub avatar, your profile picture, it'll navigate to your GitHub profile in the browser. But if you have the GitHub app installed, the GitHub iOS or Android app, then it'll launch your profile in the app. And so even to do little things like that, you have to explicitly call that out in the app config. Or if anybody's familiar with iOS development, it's in the info plist to say, hey, Apple, I might request opening the GitHub app in the future. And so, yeah, when you first upload the app, before you fill out all the screenshots and the release notes, Apple will do some automated processing and they'll give you a heads up if you're missing something so that you don't, I guess, waste both of your times then clicking the submit button and waiting a couple of days to get feedback just to learn that it got rejected.
How was it? So was it accepted at that point once the GitHub login issue was resolved from Apple?
Yes, we did get that through, and that was the what I called the beta release. So I didn't use the, a lot of folks will use beta distribution tools like TestFlight, or there's one baked into the Google Play Store. But I figured, you know what? I'll get the best feedback if I just push this, even though it's a beta version, push it all the way to the App Store as if it was the official version. And then anybody can download it. I don't have to jump through any more hoops and worry about sideloading and permissions and all that crazy stuff. So that finally got the first beta edition of Git Trends in the App Store.
How was it on the Play Store, the Google Store? Was their process as difficult?
I've never had Google push back or reject anything.
So they didn't care that they couldn't log in?
No. So I don't know what that says about Google in general, but I mean, maybe they were fine with the demo mode and they were able to see the functionality without having to connect to GitHub. Maybe they did connect to GitHub, but I will say what I appreciate with Google is the fact that it runs these just, we'll say the automated tests as soon as I upload it, and you get that pre-launch report. Because there's little things in this app, because it is all open source, there's still some environment variables, some API keys that the app needs, but obviously I don't want to commit those to GitHub and share those secrets with the world. And so there has been a couple times where I have forgotten to inject those API keys into the app before submitting it. And every time the Google pre-launch report catches it. So when I see that the app can't get past the splash screen, I'm like, oh, yep, that one's on me. I forgot to include that. So yeah, the Google process is a lot easier to get through, and they include running your app on a couple different devices so you can see or make sure that it runs on certain operating systems. And you don't get to choose the devices, but it has definitely helped me avoid pushing what I call a bad app to the App Store, because it'll catch a crash or a missing file like that ahead of time.
Did you use that tool we were talking about a little earlier, Test Center, to try out your app on, you know, a wide variety of phones?
Yeah, totally. I've been using it since back in the day when I worked at Xamarin. It used to be called Xamarin Test Cloud. And then after the acquisition, it got rolled into App Center. So now it's App Center Test. But yeah, I've always been a big proponent of testing. So I say that, and I'm about to tell you how I didn't have unit tests written for the app before I pushed it to the store. But what I did for Git Trends was I wrote a suite of UI tests so that you can push it to a service like App Center Test, tell it to run on all these different devices, and UI tests allow you to mimic the user. So if a user can tap a button, you can write a UI test to tap a button. If the user can swipe text, enter text, delete text, anything the user can do, we can mimic it a UI test. So I had those user journeys mapped out, and Tested on a bunch of different devices, so I was confident it was good to go. But my plan was, and actually still is, since I'm still writing the unit test suite right now, was let me get V1 released. I'll have the UI test so I can feel confident that the app does what it's supposed to do. And then once I get version 1 released, which I just got out just a couple weeks ago, so pretty new still, I said, feature freeze, let's write our unit test suite. That way I can move forward and feel confident that if I add a new feature, or since it's open source, if anybody opens up a pull request, then we can have all these automated tools run. So like right now, I've got probably 80% of the unit tests written. So if you were to open a pull request to Git Trends, it would automatically kick off a GitHub action that builds the Android app and runs all the unit tests against it. And then in App Center, it'd also kick off a build there and run all of the UI tests. So you could submit me a pull request tonight, and I would wake up in the morning to either red or green test results, which is really nice, because even me today, when I was working on, you know, classic story, I was fixing a bug, so I fixed it. And then I committed the code and found out that I ended up breaking one of my unit tests. So since I'm the sole maintainer or main owner, maintainer on the GitHub repo, having tools like that that just are automated and check whether or not I created new bugs or broke anything are just super useful. I couldn't maintain the release cadence I'm on right now if I didn't have that confidence, or I could and just cross my fingers and hope there's no bugs in the app.
What about the bugs, though, that, let's say, aren't covered by the tests, the things that will happen when it's being used by a person in the wild?
Ooh, this is where it gets crazy, because on Android lets the phone manufacturer, so Samsung or Google Pixel, Android will let the phone manufacturer tweak the operating system. So if you've ever bought a new phone and things look a little bit different, maybe the color scheme's different or your icons are square instead of rounded, that's the device manufacturer making small tweaks to Android. And I discovered this the hard way when I first launched my first app, because somebody left a 1-star review in the App Store and said, app doesn't work, it always crashes. I'm like, no way. No. I was like, I had a whole suite of UI tests back in Xamarin Test Cloud. I had run in on 10 different devices. All the different Androids operating systems were covered. But yeah, what I learned that day was it was a Samsung Galaxy A4, I think, running Android 4.2.2. And Samsung had tweaked how it parsed the Android manifest. So Android manifest is just an XML file that contains a lot of details about like permissions. And you know, if your app wants to do things like use the GPS, like that's where you would put that in there. Yeah. And so this one unique operating system couldn't run my app. And I had to basically do some guess and check because I didn't own one of those devices. And yeah, leveraged tools like App Center Test to do that. But what was really eye-opening to me was just like, this could happen, I don't want to say infinitely amount, but the chances of this happening are pretty high. And even today, I found a crash that it's only happened once. It's only happened to one user. I think the user was in Russia using a device that I hadn't heard of, but it was a crash happening at the operating system level. So it wasn't even my code running yet before the app crashed. It's like, oh, I don't even know how to fix this one. So yeah, you're going to see all sorts of weird behavior, especially the fact that mobile apps run on phones and people use that on the go. So people are on the bus or on a plane, and maybe you have Wi-Fi, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, maybe you don't have Wi-Fi, you go through a tunnel, and you have to kind of build this resiliency into your app to kind of anticipate this and handle this. But no, you'll never think of every scenario out of the box. So definitely anticipate crashes like that when you push to the App Store, and that's okay.
Do you do you send back those crash details without the user's explicit permission? Is it kind of is a part of the agreement when you download the app, or is it something that gets put into an email and the person goes, "Yeah, send it to Brandon"?
Good question. Yeah, the kind of de facto standard in mobile apps nowadays is to include these, the analytics and crash reporting tools, and that's all reported in the privacy policy. So before you can publish to the stores, both iOS and Android require you to have a privacy policy filled out. And yeah, I know it's weird because yeah, as a user, I kind of would lean towards not sharing that info. I mean, there's no personally identifiable information in it. If there is, then obviously you have to go through GDPR regulations and all that fun stuff. But yeah, as a developer, it is, I don't know how I could live without it, because what you would then rely on. So if you had no crash reporting, you're hoping that somebody is nice enough to say, or to like find my contact info, reach out to me, report this bug, and they're going to have to pull the stack trace from a log file on Android, and they'll have to know how to do that via the command line. And so the odds of you being able to fix a bug you don't, well, the odds of you being able to fix a bug you don't know about are zero, but the odds of you finding out about this bug that's happening in the wild are very, very slim, unless you have some friendly user who also happens to be an Android developer and might empathize with you.
To go back to sort of the saga of getting the application into the two stores, are there any tools from Xamarin or other companies that can, I suppose, you know, pre-test it for you or help you along the way?
Ooh, the closest one I know about pre-testing is just the one you get for free at the when pushing your app to the Google Play Store and the Android, the pre-launch report, which is why I've always done that extra step to make sure I have the UI tests written ahead of time and now doing the unit test. But yeah, you should probably have unit tests written ahead of time too. I don't know. I'm curious. Do you know?
Is that a trick question? I know nothing about app development. No.
I remember back in the day, a coworker of mine at Xamarin, awesome guy, Glenn Wester, he and I were chatting about what if we made a library that did that. So we called it monkey testing because Xamarin, our mascot, is a monkey. And kind of the idea is just randomly tapping buttons and mashing the keyboard to enter text. And we'll just write a recursive algorithm that just looks for stuff to interact with. And we never did get around to it. But yeah, that's always something I thought would be really nice, because although the tests would not be repeatable, it would at least help you know that there is a problem somewhere. So best case scenario, you crash the app and you can see the bug in the crash report. Worst case scenario, you discover some weird edge case that's never happened before, and you might not be able to replicate it right away, but it's going to kind of exist in the back of your mind, and maybe a year down the road, it'll kind of click when you're working on something else and be like, oh, that's what was doing it. But no, I wish there was. If anybody's listening and knows of one, do let me know, because I would love to utilize that and share it with fellow mobile app developers, because yeah, that's a must for, or testing your apps ahead of time is a must.
How would they get in touch with you?
Good question. The best way to get in touch with me is on Twitter. My handle is The Code Traveler. So I used to travel a lot before we all got locked into our homes during this pandemic, but yeah, love writing code, love traveling. So The Code Traveler.
How do we find your app? Service. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just say, feel free to shoot me a message if you want to chat about mobile, Xamarin, C#, .NET, Async Await, GraphQL. Those are kind of my bat signals. Anytime anybody brings those conversations, I'm in.
Yeah, and actually, the two podcasts we made were on Async Await, and I think we talked about adding a third part to that, and I can't remember quite what the topic was, but we'll figure it out. How do people find your application in the app stores or the source code? Can you quickly give the names and repos?
Absolutely. The app is called Git Trends. So it's G-I-T, like GitHub, and then trends, like something's trending on the app store. So T-R-E-N-D-S. So if you just search for Git Trends, all one word, it'll show up in the app stores. And yeah, the code is all open source. If you Google Git Trends GitHub, it should show up as one of the top search results. Or I've also linked to it. I created a Twitter handle, Git Trends App, that in the bio has a link to it. So if the only thing you remember is my Twitter handle, The Code Traveler, you can check out my bio. It says creator of Git Trends App, which will link you to the Twitter handle for Git Trends, which in its bio it has a link to the repo. But yeah, I think we're the only thing out there, or at least for me. I don't know if my search results are probably curated for me, so that makes sense why it pops up first. But yeah, anytime I Google Git Trends, G-I-T-T-R-E-N-D-S, one word, it's always at the top.
I'll include links in the show notes for all this. Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Brandon?
Yeah, I do want to say just thanks to everybody involved. I think a huge shout out goes out to Luis Pulhos. He's a fellow Xamarin developer and who I now know is a app designer extraordinaire. He took this ugly beta version of Git Trends that I designed and turned it into this just beautiful app. And I don't know how he came up with it, but I'm so glad he did. He just reached out to me one day and said, "Hey, what do you think of these designs?" And then he and I have worked together to implement that for version one. And then, yeah, on top of that, because it is open source, we've already had a handful of fellow developers in the community opening pull requests, adding new features, requesting new features in the issues tab, and also just forking it to play around with it to understand how to do things that they're trying to do in their app. And just the love from the community has been overwhelming. So yeah, big, big thank you to everybody who has visited the repo, said nice things, shared it with your friends, or even just left a nice review on the App Store. I really do appreciate it.
Great. And is your wife happy with how it looks now?
Yes.
So that pause was accompanied by a 90 degree head turn as you looked towards someone off camera.
Yeah, she can't. I've got my headphones on, so she can't hear us, but she approves. That's what that glare means, right?
Well, Brandon Minnick, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thanks again for having me, Brad.
If you liked this episode with Brandon, check out our other two podcasts, episode 133 and 134, on common mistakes in async await code. Thank you.
The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was A Way to Get By by Scott Grattan from the album Found and Lost.